All right, we began the last session with an interesting quote from Edward Terrell in the Broadmead Records. I want to come this session to how the Baptists came to England. But let's hear another writer, or actually this is a group of writers, five men, how they describe their own churches. Now they're writing in the year 1689, which is the year that our confession is identified with. Listen to what they wrote. This is at the beginning of Philip Carey's book on believers' baptism. And it's entitled To the Reader. I'll read you about the first page or so here. We are doubtless brought forth in a day to which many glorious prophecies in the Holy Scriptures have a special reference. Amongst others, that which is recorded, Daniel 12:4, many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall be increased. Anti-Christian darkness hath so covered the European nations for many hundreds of years that the truths and ordinances of Christ were generally corrupted and obscured, till our blessed reformers, Luther, Calvin, etc., were raised up in some good measure to detect the corruptions of Antichrist and to bring to light that blessed doctrine of justification by faith in the blood of Christ with several other truths of great importance. And since that, God has been pleased to raise up many learned men, namely Dr. Ames, that's William Ames, Mr. Ainsworth, that's Henry Ainsworth, and Dr. Owen, John Owen, with others, who have learnedly and with much clearness and strength of argument made it appear that a true gospel visible church is to consist only of such as are saints by profession, and who give up themselves to the Lord and one to another by solemn agreement to practice the ordinances of Christ. And now of latter years, the Lord hath been pleased to raise up some worthy and learned men to detect the vanity of infant baptism, who by solid arguments have made the unlawfulness thereof appear. And then they go on and they talk about these arguments, the main arguments. We freely acknowledge that many learned and holy men whom we much honor do differ from us in the point of baptism. Yet we must not let go any truth of God for their sakes. And we doubt not, but the time is drawing nigh when God will cause the light of his holy word so to shine forth that all remaining darkness on the minds of the Lord's people shall vanish away, and then Zion's builders shall no more take a stone for a corner, nor a stone for a foundation of Babylon's rubbish. Excuse me. Now you hear the point that they're making. Europe was in darkness, and along came the reformers sent by God, and they brought light. And then after them, others came along, Owen, Ainsworth, and William Ames. And they taught us what the nature of the church is. But now, in this most recent generation, the Lord has raised up others who reject the practice of infant baptism and have taught us the principles of believers' baptism. Now, what I want to do right now is tell you the story of how that happened. Let's begin by saying this. We have to recognize that in England, in the 17th century, that's the 1600s, there are two groups of Baptists, largely, generally speaking. Really, there's about five, but let's reduce it to two. The first group, who are outside of our story, but they deserve to be mentioned, are a group that are known as General Baptists. And the reason that they're called General Baptists is that they believed in a general atonement. That is, they were Arminian in their theological leanings and understanding. And they were their identification is that of Arminianism. Now, they appear on the scene first in the Netherlands. They weren't Dutch. They were actually English. They were separatists who had to leave England, fled to the Netherlands for safety, and there in the Netherlands adopted a practice of believers' baptism in the year 1612. Now, their most important leader was a man named John Smith. And sometimes he's known as the self-baptizer. John Smith, the Latin is the sea Baptist. He very quickly believed that he had made a mistake, and he took a large portion of the church with him, and they went and they joined the Mennonites, and they really were lost to history after joining the Mennonites. But there was a small portion of that church that believed that what they had done by baptizing themselves, John Smith is called the self-baptizer because he baptized himself, then he baptized others. They came to believe that this was a ceremony that was legitimate. It was right for them to do it. And they continued on. And they returned in 1612 to England under the leadership of a man named Thomas Helwys. Helwys had some relatives who were fairly highly placed at the king's court. And Helwys seems to have believed that if he returned to England with this little church, took up residence in London, that he and the church would be able to be protected by his relatives at court. Of course, that didn't happen. Helwys very quickly published a book in which he appealed to the king to give them freedom to practice their newfound faith, and Helwys was quickly put in jail and never came out of jail as a result. That's the earlier strand of English Baptists, the General Baptists. They are important in their own way. Their story deserves to be told, but we can't be sidetracked tonight to tell it. Instead, I want to focus our attention upon another group of Baptists who are called Particular Baptists. Now, you wonder why these Particular Baptists were called Particular Baptists. And the reason is that they were very particular in their theology. That is, they believed in particular redemption. They were Calvinists. And so they were known, or they have come down to us, to be known as Particular Baptists because of that doctrine. So generally speaking, you can identify the two different groups of English Baptists as Particular or Calvinistic Baptists and General or Arminian Baptists. They clearly have distinct origins. One does not begin out of the other. We said the General Baptists came first. Certainly they did. But the Particular Baptists were not Arminians who became Calvinists. They have a completely different origination, and that's the story that I want to tell you right now. Now, here's the question I want to begin with. And today, I have a higher expectation of you than when I began doing this 15 years ago. All right? Can any of you name any 17th century Particular Baptists? Now, I just said that I have higher expectations than I did 15 years ago. Can anybody name some? Now, I know that Pastor Doug can. Anybody else? Oh, shame, shame. Okay, well, by the end of the day tomorrow, I hope you'll be able to name some. Let's put it that way.
You had two on your flyer. You got the last 3 weeks.
I don't think their names were there, though. Just pictures. Yeah. So they could have been anybody, but okay. Let me give you a date to remember. The date to remember is January 1642. Okay? Put that into your minds and remember that date. January 1642. It's in January 1642 that we have the first clearly identifiable Particular Baptist church practicing baptism by immersion. But we have to back up in order to tell a story. In our last hour, we at least very briefly made it through the life of Queen Elizabeth, who died in 1603. And she died childless. She didn't have any heir to the throne. Henry VIII was very concerned about the succession of his dynasty. And it lasted for about just under 100 years, 94 years. But Edward died childless. He died at age 15. Mary died childless. And Elizabeth, who followed Mary, died childless. So Henry VIII had three children who sat upon the throne, but he had no grandchildren who sat upon the throne. And that created what might have been a crisis for England, But as you know, there are many lines of succession. And so James the VI of Scotland, who was related to Henry's ancestors and was the next in line to the throne, when Elizabeth died, James the VI of Scotland was called to come to England and take up the throne of England. He was about 35 or 40 years old at that time, had been king of Scotland virtually since he was born, although when he was a child, of course, he could not exercise his rule over the land. James became James the I, and we need to say some things about James and about the Church of England in 1603. Most of the leadership of the Church of England under Elizabeth had some exposure to the Reformed churches of the continent of Europe. And it's largely agreed that while the worship of the Church of England under Elizabeth was not Reformed, that is, it looked a lot like Roman Catholic worship, and that's why the Puritans objected so strongly to what was happening. It was a worship of, to use the language, smells and bells, incense and the sound of bells and stained glass. And the thing that they hated most was the costume of the clergy. You'll read about a gown that it was expected ministers would wear when they were performing their service called the surplice, S-U-R-P-L-I-C-E. And it was a white outer garment that would be worn over a robe that the minister would wear when in the pulpit. And the Puritans hated the surplice. They just objected strenuously to it. Many of them were hounded out as a result. Now, saying that, most of the clergy of the Church of England, by the time that Elizabeth died, were Calvinists in terms of their doctrine of salvation. There was a consensus in the church that was Calvinistic. They may have still been adhering to some outwardly Roman practices in terms of worship, but in terms of their theological commitment to the doctrine of salvation, they believed in the Reformed faith. Now, James had been king of Scotland, and Scotland, of course, was a fully Reformed country. In fact, we could even say that it was a Presbyterian country. And when James came to the throne, the Puritans of England, who were in the Church of England, were very hopeful that he would be the one now, finally, to lead the church forward into a full-blown Reformation. So about 1,000 of them signed a petition and asked James for a meeting with some of their representatives so that their concerns for the future health and development of the Church of England might be heard. He came to the throne in 1603, and the conference was held at Hampton Court Palace, one of Henry's old palaces, in the year 1604. Now, it was carefully orchestrated by James, in which he only allowed 3 representatives from the Puritan party to come and talk to him. And they were some of the, I hope this makes sense, some of the least Puritan of the Puritans. That is, they were not rigorous in their demands. They weren't willing to ask for very much. And many people think that they were chosen to by James to come and speak to him because he knew that their demands would be very mild demands, and he would be able to say that he had heard from the Puritan party at that point. James never had any idea, he never had any desire to give in to any of the concerns of the Puritans. The only good thing, really, that came out of the Hampton Court Conference in 1604 was that James recognized the time was right to provide a new translation of the Bible into English. And the King James Version, as we know it, published in 1611, is a result of the Hampton Court Palace. But that's the only positive thing that came out of that meeting at Hampton Court. Now, one of the most famous phrases that is attributed to James, he apparently spoke it at the Hampton Court Palace Conference, is 4 words that really describe to us what his concern was all about. The Puritans were largely Presbyterian. The Church of England was Episcopalian. It had a structure in which bishops had responsibility over churches. And the Puritans didn't see that the doctrine of episcopacy was taught in the scriptures in the New Testament. They believed that Presbyterianism was taught there. So part of their concern in asking for this conference was that James be willing to reform the structure of the Church of England and make it a Presbyterian church. James apparently had not gotten along very well with the Presbyterian elders in the Kirk up in Scotland, and he wanted no part of Presbyterianism. And so when the Presbyterian demand was made to him, he responded with four words: no bishop, no king. Now, those four words characterize for us James's understanding. Let's go all the way back to Henry VIII. Do you remember what he claimed for himself when he pushed the Pope out of England? Royal supremacy was what we called it, in which he advocated that he was the one who had the right to rule the Church of England within his own empire, within the boundaries of his monarchy, which was essentially England and Wales and Ireland at this point. He was the one who had the right to rule over the church. Well, James inherited that same view. He had just the exact same view of himself as the king and the rights of the king within his own domain. When he said no bishop, no king, what he meant was, if the Episcopalian system is not in place, I cannot enforce my will as the supreme head of the Church of England on earth. Now, he knew that the Episcopalian structure was perfect for him to be able to control the church. Think about it like this. You have about 9,000 parish churches scattered throughout England. Many of them are far away to the west, to the southwest, and to the north. Travel is very difficult. To travel from the north of England to the south of England, many people preferred actually to take a ship, to go out to the coast, take a ship down the coast, and then come to port, and then come cross-country to London. They preferred to do that rather than traveling cross-country all the way from north to south or south to north. There were many dangers. Travel was exceedingly difficult. How far can you go on foot carrying with you any goods every day? If you're really fit and you really work hard and the weather is good, perhaps could you go 25 miles a day? Could you do that? Does that mean that when we went out to gyms today to walk through the fields and look for pheasants, it's about 25 miles from here. Is that roughly right? That would take a day to walk out there and then a day to walk back. Now think how far spread this country is. You have no means of communication, but everyone in the country is required by law to attend church every Sunday. And the king was able to use the churches as a place where his proclamations would be read. If he controls the hierarchy, if he controls the Archbishop of Canterbury and the Archbishop of York, Canterbury is the number one position in the church, York is the number two position, and then there are bishops underneath them. If he controls them, if he appoints them, and if he uses them, he can make a decree, have it copied out, send it to the archbishops, who then send it to their bishops and have it copied, and then send it out to the parishes, and at least theoretically, within a couple of weeks, Henry can communicate with all of the populace of England. Not Henry, James. And James realizes that he has in place the perfect mechanism by which he is able to control the country. And so he says, no bishop, no king. He's completely unwilling to move forward. Now, one of the men who was deeply involved in the Hampton Court Conference was a Puritan by the name of Henry Jacob. And Jacob, at this point, 1604, is a loyal defender of the Church of England. He had high hopes that Reformation could be brought to the Church of England and it could, as a body, move forward. But Jacob was bitterly disappointed by the response that came from the king. The King James Bible, what we call it, the Authorized Version, the King James Bible was a good thing, but that's all that came out of it. And Jacob is typical of the Puritans, who are simply unhappy that their new king was unwilling to move forward. So Jacob, he actually went into exile for a couple of years, but came back to England. And in 1616, he did something very unusual, but very important. And that is that he formed a congregation in London that was illegal because it was formed outside of the Church of England. Now, we need to say a couple of things about this church, Henry Jacobs Church. First off, we need to say that it wasn't a separatist church. Now, what do I mean by that? Most separatist congregations would say that the Church of England was anti-Christian, that the clergy of the Church of England were wolves in sheep's clothing. They would use all kinds of loaded negative language to make the Church of England appear as bad as they possibly could. That's why they separated from it. But Jacob didn't do that. Jacob could not in his own conscience submit to the bishops, but Jacob believed that the Church of England was still a true church, that the ministers of the Church of England were still true ministers, and that he could fellowship with these people. So while he started a church that was outside of the structure of the Church of England, he didn't unchurch the Church of England. Does that make sense? I hope you understand the point that I'm trying to make. So usually when you read about Jacob's church, it's called a semi-separatist church. On the one hand, it's separatist because it's not under the structure of the Church of England. But on the other hand, it doesn't take on the typical characteristics of the separatists who throw stones, metaphorically, through the stained windows of the Church of England every time that they possibly can. Jacob doesn't do that. Now, remember what we said just before the break? I think it was Claire was asking the question about infant baptism, and I started to talk about the implications of what it meant, church and state. Well, it really comes to impinge on the Jacob church at this point. Because let's say that you're probably not in the aristocracy. You probably don't have a lot of money, but let's say you're from the merchant class. Now, the merchant class was roughly equivalent to what we call the middle class today. And many Puritans were from the merchant class. Jacob's congregation would have been made up of the merchant class, or roughly equivalent to the middle class today. They would have had a business. They probably would have had some land. They would have had some status in society. They might not have been recognized by the aristocracy, but they weren't peasants either. They were in the middle, and they had something at stake. Now, if you go and join Henry Jacobs Church, what do you do when it comes time to baptize your child? Now, you've been baptized in the Church of England. You can go to whatever parish you were born in, or whatever parish you were baptized in, and the church clerk would be able to open up a leather-bound book and turn to the page and demonstrate and prove that you had been baptized, thus you were a subject of the king because of your baptism in the Church of England. That could be done for you. But what happens when you have a child? Now, in the early days of the Henry Jacob Church, they seem to have continued to go down to the Church of England and have their children baptized there. We just said it was a semi-separatist church. And so they didn't compromise. It was part of their principle to recognize that the Church of England was still a true church. Thus, they could use that baptism to legitimize their children. But as the years passed, as King James dies in 1625, and his son, Charles I, comes to the throne, Charles I again changes the direction of the Church of England and begins to head it back towards Roman Catholicism. In fact, he elevates to the position of Archbishop of Canterbury a man named William Laud, L-A-U-D. And Laud was the highest churchman of the high churchmen. He made demands upon all of the parishes of the Church of England. For example, when the Reformation came, the physical layout inside the church was generally changed. Under Romanism, if you ever go to England, pay attention to the churches, the ancient churches, and how they're built. In almost all cases, they are built in such a way that the end of the church where the priest would stand, where the Mass would be performed, is on the eastern end of the church. You can tell which way the sun rises and sets by the way that the churches are built. And the reason that they did that was that they believed that when you looked at the consecrated host, when the priest held it up, you should be looking towards Jerusalem, which was to the east. So the churches were built facing the east, and the altar upon which the Mass would be offered would be at the east end of the church. The Reformation came along and it said, that's superstitious. They tore down the altar. They took away what was called the rood screen. The rood, R-O-O-D, was where the crucifix would be displayed. They took all of that stuff down, and they made preaching more central in the church. Well, when William Laud came to power as the Archbishop of Canterbury, he wanted to revert so that he reintroduced altars to be established at the east end of the church. And there was to be what was essentially a fence. It was a railing that was put up to keep the people away from the altar. And then the rood screens would have been placed up again, and crucifixes would have been nailed up to that, so that you bow down to this crucifix that was before you. And the priest, dressed now in vestments with the surplice and all the rest, would there perform the sacrifice of the Mass in front of you. Now, they didn't acknowledge the Pope, but in almost everything else, they were Roman Catholic. Charles was moving the church back in the direction of Rome, and William Laud was the point man for this. Laud had two key planks in his theological program. The first of them is what I call aggressive Arminianism. Now, remember what I said before? Under James, by the time King James comes to the throne, most of the leadership of the Church of England is Calvinistic. But when Charles I comes to the throne, and he appoints William Laud, Laud sends out an edict to the Church of England, and he says, you cannot interpret theology in a Calvinistic framework. Now, that's especially strange because the Church of England had an official body of doctrine, the equivalent of a confession of faith, that is called the 39 Articles. And the 39 Articles are thoroughly Calvinistic. How many of you know the name J.C. Ryle? Right? Most of us know Ryle, 19th century Bishop of Liverpool, great English writer. The Banner of Truth has reprinted many of his works. We're using some of his works on the Gospels in our family devotions right now. They're brilliant, wonderful stuff. J.C. Ryle referred to his church, the Church of England, as the Reformed Church of England, and his proof was the Calvinism of the 39 Articles. That was his basis for claiming that his church was a Reformed church. No one with any theological understanding could read the 39 Articles and understand them in any other sense but Calvinistic. And William Laud comes along and he says, no longer can you interpret them in a Calvinistic sense. How else can you interpret them? And he began a process of persecuting anyone who believed in Calvinism. Now, the other plank in his theological program for the Church of England, number one was aggressive Arminianism. The second one was high church sacramentalism. Now, I've read some of Laud's writings in which he talks about infant baptism, for example, and the application of the water to the baby, which puts grace in the heart. And I read that writing of William Laud, and I ask the question, how does this differ from the Roman Catholic view of the first sacrament of infant baptism? And I can't see how it differs. And Laud required the ministers of the Church of England to introduce and practice this kind of high church sacramentalism. The gospel is done away with. And now it's following the seven sacraments of the church. They still haven't recognized the Pope. But it's a very Romanist approach to Christianity. And Laud is saying, this is what you must do. Now, what happened was this was the source and the beginning of what's called the Great Migration, where many of the Puritans went to one of two places. Either they went to the Netherlands, so you had men like Thomas Goodwin, you probably have heard of him, and Jeremiah Burroughs. They went to the Netherlands, but all the rest, where did they go? Who can tell me? They came to the Massachusetts Bay Colony, and they settled in New England. And they established a Puritan church here in what they call the Howling Wilderness in New England. My wife is a descendant of them. My wife on one side is a Mayflower descendant. They were the ones, and that's why they came. Because Charles I and William Laud were persecuting them. Aggressive Arminianism and high church sacramentalism. Now, let's come back to Jacob's church in London. 1616, it's semi-separatist. He has a lot of friends within the Church of England. He's not condemning them. His own conscience and the conscience of the members of his congregation cannot gladly sit in the congregation of the Church of England, but they don't condemn it either. And they recognize that the ministers are true ministers, that the gospel is truly preached there, that they can fellowship with them. And so their people go down there for baptism. They baptize their infants. But the Church of England changes. Jacob dies in 1625. He's followed by a man named John Lathrop. James dies. James I dies. Charles comes to the throne. Things start to change in the Church of England. And members of this church, now pastored by John Lathrop, are starting to have cases of conscience. Because it's not just the good Puritan men who had been the friends of Henry Jacob that they have to go to. Now they have to go to men who perhaps are saying that when their babies are baptized, grace comes into their hearts, and that's the beginning of the process of salvation. And they don't believe that at all, because they're committed to the Reformation doctrine of justification by grace alone, through faith alone, in Christ alone. Not by the moistening of the forehead by some drops of water. And so they begin to question whether or not they can actually bring their children to the Church of England to have them baptized. And in 1633, a separation takes place in Jacob and Lathrop's church. Jacob the first pastor, Lathrop the second pastor. A separation takes place because there's a group of members of the church who no longer can tolerate others in the congregation going down to the Church of England to have their babies baptized. They believe that it's wrong for them to do so. So in 1633, another congregation begins. This is a full-blown separatist congregation that will have nothing to do with the Church of England. Okay? I hope you're following me. We've got two churches now. The Jacob Lathrop Church, still semi-separatist, struggling to maintain positive relations with the Church of England. And the second congregation, which hives off, wants nothing to do with the Church of England. Now, the Jacob Lathrop Church continues. Lathrop leaves, and he comes to the Plymouth Colony, just outside of Boston, south of Boston, the Mayflower Colony. He comes there, spends the rest of his life there, and is buried just north of Plymouth, Massachusetts today. And so the church needs another minister. And they call its third minister, he was a man named Henry Jesse. And the church is known to us historically as the Jacob Lathrop Jesse Church because of the names of the first three pastors. You know, back then, they didn't call themselves Community Baptist Church. They didn't have names like that. They just were a church. And so we have to give them a name historically, and we've chosen to give the name of the three pastors. Sometimes it's just called the JLJ Church. You have this church, and Jesse comes along to be the pastor. They have already been struggling about the issue of baptism in their church, and they've seen a separation. The separation is not about believers' baptism. It's about whether or not you can bring your babies down to the Church of England and have them baptized. But the issue of baptism is present in their church, and they are struggling with it. 5 years later, 1638, a man named John Spilsbury is part of that congregation. And Spilsbury, in the midst of this discussion about baptism and infant baptism, seems to begin to examine the scriptures and say, wait a minute, it's a good question to ask, can we go down to the Church of England to have our babies baptized there, but wait a minute, shouldn't there be an earlier question we should ask? Should our babies be baptized at all? He asked this question. Now, the Jacob Lathrop Jesse Church is also a very strongly Calvinistic Puritan church. Do you remember Laud's other position? Aggressive Arminianism and high church sacramentalism. Those are the two. You have this Calvinistic church practicing infant baptism, struggling to understand its own identity and its relationship to the Church of England. These issues are going on all around them. Many of their friends are being driven to the Netherlands or to New England, and there they are in the city of London, struggling for existence. The question of baptism and its relationship to the doctrines of the gospel is present right there in the church, and men begin to wonder, should we even ask the question, should infants be baptized? And so Spilsbury begins to think through the issue, and he comes to the conclusion that infant baptism itself should be rejected. And so in 1638, the Jacob Lathrop Jesse Church loses another group of their people. Now, I suppose I need to say one thing at this point. We're not talking about church splits in the way that you and I know church splits today. You know, one of the things that I have enjoyed about all the work that I've done in the 16th and 17th centuries, especially the 17th century, is the appreciation and respect that people have for the consciences of others. It's amazing how in circumstances like this, in the Jacob Lathrop Jesse Church, individuals could come to a new conviction and be respected for coming to that new conviction, even when there was disagreement. So we shouldn't think of the 1633 separation, as a bunch of people getting really angry with red faces and loud voices and walking out, because it didn't work like that. It was more like you're concerned about whether or not we can bring our children down to St. John's over here to have them baptized, and your conscience won't permit you to do this, and you want to begin a new congregation, please go with our blessing and do that. That's what it was like. And in 1638, when Spilsbury comes to the conclusion that baptism should no longer be for children, it seems to have been something similar. You've come to the conclusion that you should no longer baptize your babies. We don't agree with you, but go with our blessing and begin a new congregation. And so in 1638, John Spilsbury begins what is really the first Calvinistic Baptist Church. Now, it's not January 1642 yet. Remember that date? It's 4 years earlier. I said before, January 1642 is the most important date. Well, what's the story? Well, Spilsbury probably, well, certainly, is not baptizing by immersion yet. I don't know how they baptized. There's a couple of possibilities. The most likely possibility is that they took a wet cloth and wash the face, because baptism sometimes in the New Testament is called washing. It was a believer's baptism, but not a believer's baptism by immersion. But you have a church in 1638 that is formed in London, practicing a form of believer's baptism. All right? So the Jacob Lathrop Jesse Church had a separation in 1633 over the issue of whether or not it was right to bring your children, your babies, down to the Church of England for baptism. In 1638, they have a separation over the issue of believers' baptism. But we're not done with the Jacob Lathrop Jesse Church yet. We have to come back to them a third time. The persecution that comes upon them is very hot right now. William Laud is in power. He has the king behind him. The king is in desperate need of money and calls Parliament, and Parliament is opposed to the king, and we're on the verge of civil war. The end of the story is that Parliament and the king do go to civil war. Parliament wins, and in January 1649, the king is executed as a traitor by Parliament, and Oliver Cromwell comes to power, but we're not there yet. 1640 or so, the Jacob Lathrop Jesse Church has twice already faced difficult questions about baptism. The first time, infant baptism. The second time, believer's baptism. We have records that have been kept for us. I've seen them. I've photographed them. If I had my computer with me and we had a screen, I could put them up and show them to you. We have the records that were kept from this church that tell us the story. There were some individuals in the church. Now try to put yourself in their position. You've seen your friends go off. Doesn't that usually make you think? Makes you consider the possibilities. And all of these people had a very high view of Scripture. They believed that it was necessary to follow the light of the Word of God. So you have two separations, and you have a group of people who take the Bible seriously, and it's their friends who have left them. And they begin to struggle again with the question of baptism. But this time, they struggle with the question of believers' baptism and the mode of baptism as well. And it's very interesting what they did in the Jacob Lathrop Jesse Church. They had what they called conferences. Now, I've heard the word conference used for this weekend. Is that right? Yeah. Their conferences were not like this, where they flew in a guy from California to speak to them a couple of times. What they meant by conference is the coming together for discussion of the men of the church. And I think it was on Fridays. I could be incorrect. But once a week, in the evening, they invited all of the men of the church to come together to bring their Bibles and to discuss theological issues. And for a full year, they discussed believers' baptism. They spent a whole year struggling with this issue, looking up every text in the Scripture, wrestling with the text, discussing the text, and they finally, in 1641, came to the conclusion that not only should they adopt the practice of believers' baptism, but they should also adopt the practice of believers' baptism by immersion. Now, at this point, immersion is not being practiced in anywhere in England. There are no immersionists. The General Baptists are not practicing immersion. Spilsbury didn't practice immersion. The Church of England didn't practice immersion. And if they did, it would have been only babies. There was no practice of immersion. One of the concerns that they had was, would it be legitimate for them to begin this practice by themselves? Did they have to have it from someone before them? Well, they came to the conclusion that that wasn't necessary, but they still didn't know how to do it. So what they did was they took one of their men named Richard Blunt, who could speak Dutch. And they knew that there were some Mennonites over in the Netherlands who did practice baptism by immersion, and they sent Blunt over there to witness it. And he went over to one of the groups of the Anabaptists called the Rheinsbergers. They're an interesting group. They weren't actually a church. The best thing that I can call them is a parachurch. They didn't think of themselves as a church, but they did practice believers' baptism. So these people, knowing nowhere else to go, learning of the Rheinsbergers, sent Blunt over there. He went over there and he witnessed their practice of believers' baptism. I wish there were a description of what he saw. We don't have that. But he came back to London and apparently explained to the men in the Jacob Lathrop Jesse Church what he had seen. And they came to the conclusion that they should go ahead and practice believers' baptism by immersion among themselves. And so in January of 1642, they went down to the Thames and 52, if not 56, I probably have it in my notes here. My notes say 53. 53 people were baptized in January of 1642. Now, let's pause to think about that for a few moments. London is further north than Fargo, North Dakota. What is the sun like in mid-January in Fargo? What time does it rise in the morning and what time does it set? Pretty late in the morning, pretty early in the afternoon. I'm from Massachusetts, so I know what short winter days are like. And you're further north than where I grew up. Your winter day will be shorter than mine. And in England, it's even shorter. I've been there in January. In fact, I was there many years ago at high noon. It was 12 o'clock. I know that because Susie was in a stroller, and we were at Big Ben, and she and I counted together the 12 chimes of Big Ben. So she must have been 4 years old, maybe 5 years old. So 9 or 10 years ago, we were there. And I can remember walking from Buckingham Palace, which is the in-town home of Queen Elizabeth, down to Westminster Abbey and the Houses of Parliament. It's not a very long walk. I can remember walking that walk and looking to the south and being amazed at how low in the sky the sun was. Now, you know what I'm talking about. It's really low, and the day is really short, and I'll tell you what, it was really cold. Now, here's another interesting little fact. Climatological historians tell us that from about 1350 to 1850, there was a period that's called the Little Ice Age. The Little Ice Age affected the Northern Hemisphere very strongly. Do you know, for example, I don't mean to introduce a controversial issue here, but it makes my point. Do you ever think about the fact that in Southern Europe, the alcohol drink that is consumed is wine, but in Northern Europe, it tends to be beer or whiskey or something. Do you ever think about that? Do you know, ancient archaeology tells us that vines grew in England. But from 1350 to 1850, the climate was so cold that vines could no longer grow far north in England, so that in Northern Germany, Northern France, England, Scandinavia, all of the vines, the grapevines, died out, and all that they could do to produce alcohol was to produce things that came from corn or I guess from wheat over there. It would have been wheat. And so they have a spirit alcohol culture as opposed to a grape alcohol culture. The reason for that is the Little Ice Age. Now, all right, 1642 is in the middle of the Little Ice Age, but it gets even better. From about 1640 to about 1715 or 1725, somewhere in there, there was an 85-year period that's called the Maunder Minimum. And it was the coldest 85-year period in the Little Ice Age. Now, climatological historians are able to verify this for us. There's actually a very fine book that's been written called The Little Ice Age. Now, what we have here is January 1642 at the beginning of the Maunder Minimum, which is the coldest 85 years in the Little Ice Age, and we have 53 people going down to the Thames River in London to practice baptism by immersion. And I say, wow. It's amazing. They weren't willing to wait until the spring thaw, whenever that would come. I don't know when it came. They took a year. They worked hard. They discussed. And they came to the conclusion that this was right. They knew that it would cause trouble. But they came to the conclusion that it was right, and they went and they did it. And 53 people were baptized. And that day, we had the first Calvinistic Baptist church. We actually had the first English Baptist church of any kind practicing baptism by immersion. But we have the first particular Baptist church practicing believers' baptism by immersion. They were rapidly identified by the culture around them. They were considered to be heretics, and they were in grave danger. The stuff that happened is just fascinating. I know, Doug, you said that you passed out the Confessing the Faith in 1644 and 1689, and some of that material, I tell that story, some of it in there, about the opposition that came to them. Daniel Featley, for example, I don't remember if he's in there or not, if he appears. Featley was a member of the Westminster Assembly until he had to be forced out for interesting reasons, but that's another story. And Featley wrote a book in 1644, against the Baptists. He called it The Dippers Dipped. Oh, you get the idea of what it's all about. And he wanted to attack them, and he wanted to make them look as bad as he possibly could. And so what he did was, he had somebody, he understood the principle of picture is worth 1,000 words. And I actually have a copy of this. He had someone do an engraving or a woodcut or something that was placed across from the title page. All the way around it are little boxes of these strange-looking individuals, and all of them have a name that's a version of the word Baptist. And they're all meant to look like evil little gremlins. Some of them look like Vulcans, like Mr. Spock or someone. They've got pointy ears and pointy eyes, and they're made to look strange. And in the middle, there's a woodcut of a couple of men and a couple of women in a river practicing a baptism. But the problem is that the women are depicted naked. Now, there's no caption attached to it. But there didn't need to be a caption, because the message was, this new practice of believers' baptism by immersion is inherently immoral. And the men are doing it so they can get the women down there for their own wicked pleasures. That was the point of the engraving at the front of Featley's book. That's the kind of stuff that our fathers faced when they first developed the practice of believers' baptism. Within 2 years of the January 1642, they published a confession of faith. And maybe tomorrow morning we'll talk a little bit about that confession of faith and how fine it is. It's actually a very good production. We know that within 25 years or so, there were about 120 churches throughout England, most of them in the south of England, though not all of them. That's pretty decent church growth in 25 years to have 120 churches planted. And by 1715, which is, that's about 75 years later, we know of 220 particular Baptist churches scattered throughout England and Wales. Pretty decent church growth as a result of this. I guess a couple of things that we have to say. This story demonstrates to us that our particular Baptist fathers developed directly out of the Puritan separatist churches of the mid-1600s. And their theological and doctrinal or practical convictions were shaped and molded by these Puritan influences. And it's very important for us to understand that fact. Now, I remember one time I was riding with D.A. Carson. He had preached at my church, and I was taking him to the airport, and we were talking about this. And I was telling him that sometimes I wish that we had the name Puritan Baptist. And, of course, you can't have it. And he laughed, and he said, yeah, what would people think if that's what you called yourself, a Puritan Baptist? People have such a bad conception of what Puritans are. Do you know why Puritans wore black? When in popular literature, when you read about Puritans dressing in black, the idea is that they did this because they were so sober-minded and somber, and they didn't have any fun, and they didn't love life and all the rest. You know why Puritans wore black? They wore black because they had money, and because black was an expensive kind of clothing. It was, the cheap clothing was colored red or white or yellow. The expensive clothing was colored black. It was a status symbol of their relative wealth to wear black. It didn't have anything to do with religious convictions. But if we used the name Puritan Baptist, that's what we'd end up with, wouldn't it? We'd have people thinking that we're wearing those funny hats and walking around trying to burn witches or something. Well, that's not the case. Nevertheless, it's true that we have developed directly out of the Puritan separatist independent churches of the 17th century. Another thing that I think needs to be stressed or stated in consequence of that is that it is very profitable for an understanding of our own doctrine to understand the doctrines of those men around us. My number one go-to guy when I have a theological question is John Owen, the Puritan, even though he wasn't a Baptist. But I know that his convictions shaped the convictions of the churches that I love, the men that I love from back then, and they helped to shape my own theological convictions as well. Well, it's 10 minutes of 8 right now. I've been talking for over 50 minutes. Let's pause. I think this is a good place to pause. Maybe we can ask and answer some questions if you have any. It's a fascinating story, isn't it? Yes, there are three different views. There's no debate about this. It's just sort of what's behind it. The first view, which is the worst view, in my opinion, is the trail of blood successionism kind of view that sees a long line of churches outside of Rome that go all the way back to either Jesus and his disciples or John the Baptist. And there are a variety of ways that advocates of that view try to make their case. Now, James McGoldrick, who used to teach at Cedarville College, wrote an outstanding book examining that question. It's called Baptist Successionism. He handles it very, very well and debunks it thoroughly. One of the realities of that view is that they employ marginal sects along the way to make their case and name them as Baptists. And one of the questions that McGoldrick asks is, would you accept these people into your Baptist church today? And the answer has to be no. We'd never have them in. For example, there was one group whose baptism was to take a copy of the Gospel of John and put it on someone's head when they were 30 years of age and have them recite the Lord's Prayer. Our Father, which art in heaven, hallowed. Is that a baptism? But you see, successionists have not necessarily done their homework to examine the beliefs of these groups. They simply read somewhere that they rejected infant baptism, therefore they must be Baptists. That view, I think, has no credibility at all, although it's popular in some circles. The Anabaptist kinship view argues that there were predecessors to Baptists, not necessarily direct links, but predecessors to Baptists at different times and in different places. On the continent, the 16th century Anabaptists on the continent. I would argue that we as Baptists ought to appreciate the sacrifices that were made by the continental Anabaptists for the cause of believers' baptism. Even though there's no direct link to the English Baptists, we ought to honor and appreciate them. The best of them were men like Balthazar Hubmaier, Conrad Grebel, George Blaurock, Michael Sattler, German, Swiss men. The story of the Anabaptists is a tragic story. I don't have time to tell it. But let me say this. They develop about 1525 in Zurich. That's the first place that you see them. Most of their early leaders were from the upper classes of society. They were educated men. They'd studied at the University of Paris or in German universities. They were well-connected in the aristocracy. And within about 5 years, they were dead. They had all been cut off. They'd been killed mostly by the Roman authorities, sometimes by Protestants. They were dead. And the leadership of the Anabaptist cause then devolved largely upon peasants. And that explains many of the wild excesses of the Anabaptists. I didn't even take the time to tell the story of Munster here. One of the charges that was laid against the English Baptists is that they would be just like the wild men of Munster. And the men of Munster were wild. They believed in polygamy. They actually, at one point, they were under a siege and they practiced cannibalism and they had to be destroyed. It was a horrible situation. And in England, that happened in 1532, 100 years later, the opponents of the Baptists in England tried to smear the English Baptists with the name Munster. They were Munsterites. So the Anabaptist spiritual kinship view, I appreciate. And I think it makes some contributions by telling us that there were some groups before the English Baptists who practiced believers' baptism, not necessarily by immersion, but who practiced believers' baptism. And brothers and sisters, I believe we ought to honor their memory. I really do. But the view that I presented to you is called the English Separatist view. And historically, there's just no way around the fact that the English Baptists developed out of the English Separatists. So you're right, there are three different theories. I think that the successionist view is wrong. I have appreciation for the spiritual kinship view. And I can affirm a spiritual kinship with some of these men very well. I just this week was reading about Sattler because I appreciate Sattler. Sattler was in Strasbourg, and after he died, Martin Bucer and Wolfgang Capito, who were the two reformers of Strasbourg, wrote a testimony about Capito's character, though he was martyred as an Anabaptist. So, positive things. I hope that that answers your question. Yeah. Dr. Estep, W.R. Estep, I had a seminar with him when I was at TEDS. I was actually his TA. I got to know him a little bit, and he's very strong on the Anabaptist view. But the history of the separatist view is just solid as can be. They seem to, well, yes, they were practicing believers baptism from the start, 1612, but they seem to have adopted immersion about the same time, 1642. And they have a, there's one of their leaders named Edward Barber who wrote a treatise, in 1642 about dipping. So they seem to, my guess is they looked at these guys in January 1642 and they said, hey, they're right. Let's do this too. But that's just a guess. An educated guess, but still a guess. Right behind you there. Chris. Yeah, Chris. No, not really. Now, there is a recent book that was published in England that has sort of stirred up the waters and argued that it's fairly muddy in the early 1640s, but I'm not convinced by the argument. Knowing some of the primary sources, it just hasn't convinced me. He argues that in the early 1640s, the generals and the particulars were sort of amalgamated and then developed out by 1644 when you have this Calvinist confession of faith. I'm not so convinced about that. I know that in the following years, there's very little contact between them. And the only movement that you tend to see is from the Arminians to the Calvinists. Seldom, although every once in a while you see a Calvinist go over to the Arminian side, but more often than not, the Arminians are moving over to the Calvinist side. Claire, did I see your hand up? Well, there's two names of particular Baptists. Benjamin Cox is the father, and Nehemiah Cox is the son. Benjamin became part of the early group in the 1640s, and Nehemiah comes along in the 1670s. But we'll talk about both of them tomorrow. Jim? Well, an Anabaptist group called the Rheinsbergers. They weren't actually Mennonites. You see, Menno Simons was Dutch. And you find that Anabaptist and Mennonite tend to become the same thing in popular speech. When we say Mennonite, we mean Anabaptist. When we say Anabaptist, we mean Mennonite. Technically, this group was not, in the narrow sense, Mennonite. They were Rheinsbergers. But they were Dutch. They're also called collegians, is another name for them, because, as I said, they weren't a church. They acted collegially. That is, their leadership acted in a way that the leadership of a college would act as opposed to a church. So they're called collegians. Mm-hmm. Okay. Two good questions. The first one, Goodwin and Burroughs never became Baptists. The leadership of these churches tended to be in the 1640s. There were a handful of men who left the Church of England and became particular Baptist ministers. Benjamin Cox would be one. Hansard Knowles would be another one. But the other men, William Kiffin, John Spilsbury, Thomas Collier, these would be men who were not trained at the university for the ministry, but were ordained from within the membership of the congregations and sent out to do church planting work. They were very aggressive. For example, in 1649, there was a church in London called the Glasshouse Yard Church, and they were just called that because they met in this place called the Glasshouse Yard. And they held a day of prayer and fasting for the spread of the gospel. While they were meeting, a knock came on the door, and it was two men from Wales who had heard of the particular Baptists and wanted to do church planting work in Wales. One of them, John Miles, had been a minister in the Church of England. They knocked on the door on this day when the church was holding a day of prayer and fasting for the spread of the gospel. They were welcomed in as answers to their prayers. They were ordained and then sent back to Wales to do the work of church planting. And about five churches came in Wales as a result of that meeting that day. As the years pass, they're very concerned with finding men that they can send out and plant churches. And so they did that. And you find that, off the top of my head, in the early days, up until, say, 1660, maybe a third or 40% of the leadership had formerly been ministers in the Church of England. But once 1660 comes, that's impossible. That's largely impossible because of the change in political circumstances. Now, to get to your second question, which deals with 1660, really, is the change in political circumstances. And yes, there was a great deal of persecution. From 1649, when the king is executed, until 1660, when Charles II returns to the throne, that period called the interregnum, in which you have first the Commonwealth and then the Protectorate, and Cromwell is really the most important man in all of it. During that period, there's a real forward movement even towards religious toleration. But when Charles II comes back to the throne of England, the bishops are restored to power and they begin the process of persecution. And the persecution was aimed at the Congregationalists, the Presbyterians, and by extension, the Baptists. Now, most of the Baptists were not, most of their pastors at that point were no longer former clergy of the Church of England. So they were a little bit more anonymous, but most of the men who were Presbyterian or Congregational had been ordained in the Church of England. They were identifiable, and they were in big trouble. There was a set of five statutes called the Clarendon Code that was enacted against them, and in some cases it was really bad. We all know the story of John Bunyan and Bunyan's 12 years in Bedford Jail. Bunyan's not unusual, really. Some of our fathers, even the Baptist fathers, died in prison as a result of persecution. So, yes, there was more. Claire?
Can't help but think that
Well, covenant theology was the theological language of the day. And virtually everybody would have had some variety of covenant theology. So when you read all of the 17th century works on baptism, I think I've read them all, they all assume and grow out of a commitment to covenant theology. It's like saying English is the language of the United States of America. To really make it successfully in America, you have to speak English. And for them, the language of theology was covenant theology, and they all spoke it. I don't know if that answers your question. I don't think so much immersion, but yes, there would have been adjustments to the Presbyterian version, because that's one of the ways that the Presbyterians legitimized their practice of infant baptism, and the Baptists could not go along with that. So they formulated the confessional doctrine of covenant theology differently in order to provide a theological climate to defend believers' baptism and do away with infant baptism. So yes, there were changes. Chris? No, they didn't wrestle with it. They would say it's not a rebaptism, it is a baptism. That the infant baptism is no baptism, therefore you're unbaptized. So it wasn't, they didn't have to wrestle with it. They would just look the person in the eye and say, you're not baptized, come down to the Thames with me. And you know, it's interesting that one of my colleagues at Westminster Seminary, who is an ardent defender of infant baptism, acknowledges the fact that as far as I'm concerned, he's unbaptized. And he doesn't really have a problem with that, because he recognizes that that's consistent with what our theology is. So he calls me a rebel because I don't practice infant baptism, and yet I can call him unbaptized, and we can smile at each other. Michael Haken has a very fine little book by the title Kiffin, Keech, and Knowles. And Knowles is spelled K-N-O-L-L-Y-S. And I think it's only 6 chapters, and it's very useful as a survey of the era. Particular Baptist Press in Springfield, Missouri has a 3-volume set that's called The British Particular Baptists. I wrote one of the chapters in it. I think it's got a lot of good stuff in it. And that volume 1 is relevant to this discussion and a little bit later, but that's one that's worthwhile. Tom Nettle's book, By His Grace and For His Glory. I love Dr. Nettles. He was my PhD supervisor. The only issue that I have with him, and it's not really an issue, but it's just that he's so committed to the Southern Baptist Convention that sooner or later his books become Southern Baptist books. And once you get past 1814, that's what he wants to write about. So the later part of the book is really an emphasis on Southern Baptists that I wish was expanded out a little bit. But nonetheless, great book. That's off the top of my head, that's a couple of them that are useful. Yes, sir. Good question. About the same time, Roger Williams in Providence, Rhode Island, was struggling with the question, and another group of men in Newport, Rhode Island, which is about 20 miles east of Providence, were struggling with the question. And they formed a church in Providence, and they formed a church in Newport. They, John Clark and Roger Williams, both went to London to seek a charter for the colony of Rhode Island. And now, let me skip over some things. Just Clark, John Clark made contact with the English Particular Baptists. And it's very clear that he viewed his church on this side of the Atlantic as part of the fellowship on that side of the Atlantic. I wish I could tell you the story. One of the most famous incidents in American Baptist history is the story of Clark, Obadiah Holmes, and a man named John Crandall, who went to Lynn, Massachusetts. My father was born in Lynn. It's about 10 miles north of Boston. They went there to visit a blind man who was a member of their church, and they were arrested when they were at his house. They were arrested because they weren't attending the public worship of the Congregational Church, the Puritan Church in town. It's not because they did something else. It's because they weren't at that service. And Crandall and Clark were fined, and Obadiah Holmes was whipped outside the state house in Massachusetts. My wife's a direct descendant of Elder John Crandall. It's family history and on her side. When Clark went back to Newport, he wrote one of the most famous books in colonial American history. It's called Ill News from New England. The subtitle is really interesting. He says, while old England has become new, New England has become old. And his point is that religious toleration is starting to develop in the 1650s in old England, but in New England, you can't be a Baptist in the Mass Bay colony because you get arrested and fined or whipped. And it's very interesting in that book that he writes a letter of appeal to his beloved brethren in London, and he names Spilsbury and William Kiffin and the rest. So he views himself as one with those guys. When the First Baptist Church of Boston comes into being, that's an interesting story. I've got all these stories that I can't tell. It's just a really interesting story. They appeal to England, and two, if I remember correctly, two of their first members had been members of the Particular Baptist churches in England. So in New England, you have this cross-fertilization between old and new, the ships that are going back and forth, back and forth. The Baptists really start to develop in Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Delaware, that area. And you have the Philadelphia Association start in 1707. And they are the ones who take the Second London Confession of Faith, add two chapters of it, and publish it as the Philadelphia Confession. So in the North in New England, you have this cross-fertilization. In the middle state colonies surrounding Philadelphia, you also have a large influx of men, especially from Wales, coming over and settling there. So it's very early, and it all comes by way of the wooden ships that are crossing the Atlantic. Yeah, it's a great question, and I wish we had time to open that up. There's some fascinating stuff there, too. So, but we probably should stop at this point.